You are listening to the cycling podcast at the Giro d'Italia, supported by Science and Sport. Today we are in Arnhem.
Cozze ci tene, cozze, cozze vicine, non spigudeci ora, non spigudeci ora. Cozze ci tene, cozze, cozze vicine, non spigudeci ora, se non mangiano le femmine.
Dove siamo, Lionel?
I'm sorry, I don't speak Italian.
Writing for Nor Italy.
On the evidence of that.
Right, terrific. Italy.
I've not got very far with my coffee break Italian podcast. So
my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Daniel Freib.
Buongiorno.
And Lionel Burney.
Hello.
Hello, Lionel. A lot of that. There'll be a lot of that kind of stuff over the next few days.
You'll probably be fluent by the time I get back in Tuscany, won't you?
I think so. Yep. Definitely. We'll put you to shame, Freib. You're leaving us tonight. We're carrying on, Lionel and I, to the south of Italy. Daniel, you're heading back for a bit of R&R before you return.
Moving house.
You're moving house, yeah, exactly. So we'll carry on. We'll get Ciro involved and some other people as well. Kayleigh Fretz, we're going to have him on the podcast perhaps at times. So, you know, we'll manage. We'll manage somehow, won't we, Lionel?
We certainly will, yeah.
So what's happened today, chaps? Actually, you never answered my question.
I didn't know. That's a good point. Well, we're outside a bar, of course, in Arnhem. We're just right next to the car park space where the team buses all parked up yesterday morning before the start and this evening for the finish.
It was a bit of a frantic scene at the finish, wasn't it, with teams packing up bikes, putting them in boxes. For the riders, it's fairly straightforward and easy. They jump on a plane and wake up in southern Italy or arrive in southern Italy with limited stress. For the mechanics and so on in particular, it's very tough, and we'll be featuring that in our first kilometre zero, which will be coming out Monday morning, and it will cover the whole start in Holland, the transfer to Italy, what's involved in that in terms of logistics and so on, and a bit of history of foreign overseas starts to grand tours as well. So that will be coming out Monday morning. But we've got our flight to catch later on. We're going to review today's stage. Marcel Kittel made it two stage wins in a row, as he did 2 years ago when the Giro began in Northern Ireland, moved to Southern Ireland. Didn't on that occasion make it to Italy. Marcel Kittel, he fell ill overnight. No signs of him falling ill here so far, but he looks in incredible form. And we'll hear a little bit from Elia Viviani, who was second today, but Kittel was absolutely unbeatable, wasn't he, Lionel? Or Daniel, sorry,
well,
I can see Daniel about to speak.
His cheekbone, I mean, his sprinting looks magnificent so far in this Giro d'Italia. Again, he won almost. Did they give him the same time as second place as Viviani? I think they did, but again, it was very close to dropping the peloton, wasn't he? And you know, we talked yesterday about his makeshift train, which is actually proving to be not much of a makeshift train, but actually pretty slick. Matteo Trentin, who we'll hear from later, was influential. Van Zyl was down the road for Dimension Data, and at one stage, no one really wanted to take it on at the front. The teams were sort of looking at each other, and then finally, Etic's Quickstep went into emergency mode. And Bob Jungels, who we heard from yesterday, was quite apprehensive, wasn't he, about his role as a lead-out man in this Giro, or as part of the Etic's Quickstep train, rather. And he did a great job yesterday, and he did a great job today, and he was one of several Etic's Quickstep riders who really put Kittel, you only really, to use, you know, a footballing analogy, you only really need to put him somewhere near the penalty area, don't you? And he pretty much does the rest.
Well, we hear from Matteo Trentin, who's part of that leader train, one of the more experienced riders in that Etic's Quickstep train. I think you caught up with him at the finish, didn't you, Daniel?
I did. Here is Matteo Trentin.
It's not bad, this new train, is it? It's working pretty well.
Yeah, I think the system is working well. More you are racing together, the more you're confident to your teammate that you have in the front and that is confident on you.
And
that's why it's working pretty well.
And there are some inexperienced guys in the train, Bob Jungels, a couple of others, but they're doing a great job, aren't they?
You know, when you have a good communication, then the guys, everybody's smart enough to understand when it's time. When you do it a few times, then you start to understand the system, and then you know what to do, when to do, and how to do it. We guide them a little bit, but of course they are amazing good riders. So when you just make the tip to the start, and then they just go by themselves, they don't need it anymore.
Unfortunately, Marcel makes it look very, very easy at the end.
Why unfortunately?
Because it maybe detracts a bit from the great job that you're doing.
That's what journalists say. I don't think it attract anything because you see, second wasn't solo, second Viviani turned solo. They are here for sprinting, they are not here for having a holiday in Holland.
So that was Matteo Trentin. I think you upset him a little bit, Daniel, with one of your questions.
Well, I said that Kittel, he's making it look very easy, and it looks as though, I mean, to be honest, he looks as though we could lead him out at the moment and he would still win. And that was really what I meant by he's making it look too easy and therefore detracting a little bit from the work of the ethics.
Always asking the tough questions, aren't you, Daniel?
Yeah. brutal questions. But yeah, I think he's probably reaping some of the rewards for the work that's gone in over 2 or 3 years with some of these guys. Matteo Trentin obviously has worked under Mark Cavendish for a couple of years, and it's certainly taken Fabio Sabatini's another one we talked about yesterday. And it took them a while, certainly, and they never really got to a stage with Cavendish where they'd really nailed the lead out. But, you know, that year, 2 years apprenticeship with Cavendish, sort of ironically, bitterly for Cavendish, is probably now benefiting Kittel a little bit.
Well, when Kittel got to the finish, there wasn't a lot of doubt about him winning, was there? Once he was in front, no one was going to come round him. But did you, while you were watching, think there was a moment where perhaps the breakaway might stay clear? They had a couple of minutes with sort of 17, 18 kilometres still to go, and they were going pretty well at one point, the four men in the front. Martin Cilinghi was off the front again. His reward for that escape a second day in a row is to wear the King of the Mountains jersey, which he pulled on in front of his home crowd here in Arnhem. Johan van Zyl of Dimension Data was the last man standing. He clipped off the front of the other three, which were Cilinghi, Bellato and Ames Coeta. And Van Zyl was caught with only 1.7 to go, so it wasn't close in the end. But there was, I thought, a moment with sort of 20 kilometres left that I thought perhaps the story we were all anticipating wasn't going to happen.
Yeah, and we're back to the sort of days of Cavendish HC in his pomp, where sprint finishes were so predictable in that one guy seemed head and shoulders above everybody else. Head and shoulders, that's no reference to shampoo or anything in relation to Kittel. But the onus in those moments where it did look as though the break might stay, the onus was very much with Etics Quickstep. It wasn't up to any other team at all, and it didn't look as though they were fully committed, really, strangely. I mean, they kind of were and they weren't, but there was no... It certainly wasn't like those years from 2008 to 2011 when, you know, HC Highwood would just be en masse at the front for the last sort of 20 kilometres of the stage.
No, and I think as Patrick Lefebvre, the manager of Etics Quickstep, said in the podcast yesterday, they're not necessarily 100% confident that this is an experienced enough, strong enough team to really take the whole responsibility on days like today when it's going to be a sprint finish. And they're going to probably play some mind games with the other teams, probably try and get a bit of help, but they're not going to get any if Kittel is as superior as he was today. And, you know, all the talk early in the season about a new wave of sprinters, and I'm sure we were probably guilty of it, Caleb Ewan, Gaviria. Okay, Gaviria's not here, he's with Etics Quickstep as well. But Kittel is really a long, long way ahead, certainly in this Giro. It might be another story in the Tour de France when he's up against different riders, but even Greipel today was nowhere to be seen.
Well, you know, we talk about the other sprinters. I spoke to Elia Viviani at the start today. Before I spoke to him, I actually spoke to Rod Ellingworth, the coach at Team Sky, and Rod Ellingworth is always quite entertaining, and he said in no uncertain terms what his instruction was to Viviani, which should have been an instruction to any sprinter, was to get yourself on Kittel's wheel, give yourself the best possible chance, glue yourself to this wheel. Of course, that's the space that everybody wants, but Rod's exact words, well, not his exact words, I'll paraphrase him a little bit, but he said, I told Elia, I want you to get right up Kittel's bottom. If Kittel opens his mouth and shows his gums, I want to see your head, he said, which slight exaggeration, but you know, the instruction was clear, get as close to Kittel as physically possible. So I spoke to Viviani. He chuckled a little bit when I asked him about what his instructions were for the day. So I spoke to him before and after. You'll hear him at the start, and then you'll hear his reaction at the finish. He was second to Kittel, having done exactly what he was told to do, manoeuvred himself onto Kittel's wheel, which involved a bit of argy-bargy. But here's Elia Viviani. Your prospects today, I understand your instruction is to stick as close to Kittel as possible. Is that going to be your approach to today's stage? And what happened yesterday?
Oh, yesterday we lose the first stage, so the first chance. We know it's not the same to take the Kittel wheel and in this chaotic finish, so it's difficult. It's difficult to take a good position and also to have a good legs. Yesterday I don't have a super legs and also not good position, finishing top 15, but yeah, it's not my level of the sprint of yesterday. I need to improve today and yeah, maybe it's better if I try to do one small sprint before to take a position and then be ready for the last sprint. We try today.
How impressed were you with Kittel yesterday?
Yeah, Kittel is the strongest here. Two bikes to the second one, and the second one it was Demar. He won this Milano Sanremo this year, I think, is the really strongest one. So I need to be on his wheel for understand if I can win or not. Great. At this Giro, at this time.
Ellie, I spoke to you at the start. Much better day for you today. You seem to do everything right in terms of getting on Kittel's wheel.
Today I'm really, really focused in the last 10K to take these wheels. It's the focus of the day, and then we will see. If I spend a lot for taking the wheel, I stay on the wheel and do second, and that's what I do. So I spend a lot because it's a real, real battle on the Kittel wheels, but yeah, he is in, I think, the best form, and I can improve in the day by day. After 3 weeks without race, we are sure to be strong also the last week. So for today is the maximum we can do, and I'm really happy for the result of today.
How big a battle was it to get on that wheel? Because as you say, there were a lot of people fighting for it. You got it quite late. Was it quite a physical battle in there?
Yeah, when you see a sprint same yesterday, you know, Kittel win with two bikes with to the second, and the second is not the last one. The last one, so it's another mar. So, and today is the same with me. So Kittel is in top form, is unbelievable, and he's at the moment he's the strongest sprinter in the world. And for the moment, if you take his wheel, you can do second. So this is the maximum result for today. For that, we are happy.
Have you seen a sprinter as in kind of form that Kittel's in at the moment? I mean, as you say, he's just seems to be on a different level.
I think he's the strongest sprinter I never seen the first 7 years I do in the pro. Because, yeah, today I spend a lot for take his wheel, but when he start, I can stay on his wheel. I never think to pass him, but only for staying his wheel, and I lose a few meters. So that is strong. Yeah, strong.
So there was Viviani, Elia Viviani of Team Sky, who did all that he could. And as he said there, Kittel's the strongest sprinter he's seen in his 7 years as a pro. I mean, he's raced against Kittel a lot, but this is the best he's ever seen him. And he's never seen anybody faster or stronger. Just unbeatable. He did everything right there, but when it came to, you know, trying to maneuver himself from Kittel's wheel to overtake him, it just wasn't possible. Daniel, what are you looking at?
We haven't mentioned the general classification and whether Kittel got his pink jersey.
Kittel did get his pink jersey.
We haven't mentioned that.
No, we haven't mentioned that.
We better mention
it. We're coming to it.
We're at the Giro.
Yeah, we're at the Giro. Kittel's in the pink jersey.
This is the fight for pink.
#
Very true. Yes, he got the pink jersey. He got the bonus seconds.
And finished talking about the fight for Kittel's wheel. It was interesting watching the finish and watching the scramble. It was almost a separate race for Kittel's wheel.
Yeah, and that is only half the battle, isn't it? Because the real difficulty, of course, is really, I think there's a school of thought among the sprinters that you kind of need to drop Kittel in the first sort of 50 metres of your acceleration, and that's really the only chance, because you're not coming around him when he's going at 60 kilometres an hour and he's such a big guy, it's almost impossible. You talk about the fight for wheels there, and we mentioned Caleb Ewan. He's finding his way in this Giro. There was a lot of talk, a lot of hype about him, and I'm sure he'll get there in the end. But, you know, I remember some conversations with a couple of riders last year. They'd watched Ewan closely in some of his first World Tour races, and they said he seemed very nervous and apprehensive. And again, he'll have to learn the ropes as far as that fight for positions is concerned.
Well, Daniel, I spoke to Matt White, his DS, at the finish at Orica Green Edge, and that's pretty much exactly what he said. So let's hear from Matt White now. Caleb Ewan was perfectly positioned behind Kittel and sort of bumped off a little bit. Was that his instruction for today, to try and stick as close to him as possible?
Well, he's the fastest guy here, so it's not a bad moving target, is it?
No, no. He's not the only one, is he?
No, he's not the only one looking for Kittel's wheel. As we saw today, he got swamped either side. and just couldn't get out in time.
I mean, he's obviously really, really quick. So here, being at the Giro, is it really a learning experience for him?
It definitely is. Yeah, we all know he's quick. We've seen the races that he's won over the last year and a half. But the level and the depth of the sprinters here is... Look, the only guys who aren't here is Christoph and Cavendish. So I think we counted 11 sprinters at the start line. So it's a great experience for him to experience that depth. And the harder part for him is going to be getting to that last 200 metres where he can open up and show that speed, because the level of the bunch here makes for a lot tougher racing. But it's a good experience. He's 21 years of age.
It's kind of hard for a sprinter, isn't it? Because a sprinter is like the goal scorer. He's judged only on how he does in that sprint. How difficult is it to impress upon him the importance of it being a learning experience, and that, you know, the things that he perhaps isn't so good at the moment, muscling people out of the way, showing his elbows, so that will come with time?
It will. It would come with time and experience. But look, for us, we've said before that our main goal is, we obviously with Esteban, and to give Caleb as much experience as possible. When look, he's going to have chances to win while he's here, and yeah, he when it'll be maybe the next day or the day after. But yeah, look, he's 21. Whatever we can get out of this is going to be a bonus for him. So yeah, we're looking forward to the next day. It didn't work out today, but we've got more opportunities coming up.
Eurosport, the home of cycling.
Thank you very much to Eurosport for their sponsorship. Them and Science and Sport are sponsoring us at this Giro d'Italia. And in conjunction with Eurosport, we are launching our Pedaleur de Charme competition, something that we did last year at the Tour de France, and it went very well. If you can send in your nominations for Pedaleur de Charme, hashtag PDC Giro, and we will award Pedaleur de Charme t-shirts to riders. A couple of you have asked actually to explain what Pedaleur de Charme is, and it's an old expression that goes back to at least the 50s, possibly earlier, but the original Pedaleur de Charme was a Swiss rider called Hugo Cobley, who won the Tour de France. He was also the first non-Italian to win the Giro, and Cobley was famous for his elegance, his class. Apparently he used to ride with a comb in his back pocket, a bottle of eau de cologne. He was a very classy, he used to do his hair for the photographs at the finish and so on. Very classy guy. So Pedaleur de Charme basically means any kind of classy, elegant riding, somebody who looks good on a bike or performs or, you know, does some kind of classy gesture.
Yeah, no one who pedals like they're stomping on grapes.
Exactly. Yeah. I want, just on Cobley, he did, as so many great cyclists have done, he had a tragic end. He was still pretty young. He was only 39 when he crashed his white Alfa Romeo into a tree. And this was rumoured to be an elaborate suicide, because he was seen driving his car past the tree twice before finally driving headlong into it, as though he'd been considering it. So very sad. His Swiss contemporary, Ferdy Kubler, is still alive, isn't he? He's in his 90s and he's still alive in Switzerland, living in an old folks home, I believe.
The oldest living Tour de France champion, I think.
Yeah,
Ferdy Kubler.
Very much so.
We're talking about the 50s here, aren't we, Richard?
Yes, Ferdy Kubler won the Tour de France in 1950, and Hugo Cobley won it in 1951. So a little period of Swiss domination for a couple of years there. But yeah, Ferdy Kubler is the oldest living Tour winner, and as I say, Hugo Cobley, the original Pedaleur de Charme, suffered a tragic end.
But we're not here to talk about the Tour de France at the moment, are we? Historic or otherwise?
No, but we're going to segue neatly from talking of Pedaleur de Charme, and do keep your nominations coming in, into somebody who wasn't pedaling quite so charmingly today, Daniel. Somebody that you caught up with on the finish.
Well, you said that Cobley and Kubler were the great Swiss stars of their day. Cancellara, of course, is the great Swiss star of the current day. He struggled yesterday with diarrhea, illness. He was a little bit better today, got dropped to the end. But another rider who was suffering pretty badly on the road today was Jascha Suterlin of Movistar, German rider. He came in, I think, just over 13 minutes down, looking very downbeat, very pallid, and I caught up with him at the finish line just as he crossed the line, and he told me, or he confirmed to me, that he'd been suffering with illness all day.
Of the Giro d'Italia.
That was a tough day, no?
Yeah. I was sick this night. I had problems with my stomach. I tried to hold the peloton, but I think at kilometer 120, it was too fast for me, and so I dropped.
Do you think you'll make it to Tuesday, or, well, you're hopeful anyway?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So I want to finish the Giro for Valverde to help him, and yeah, I want to do my job.
And you won't forget the Giro's trip to Holland in a hurry. It's been a pretty intense experience for you.
Yeah, for sure. It's my first Grand Tour. Yeah.
So that was Sutil, and we do hear from a lot of riders who've done well, clearly, and you know are involved in the race in a different way. But somebody like him, he's not untypical, is he, as somebody who's struggling and suffering already?
No. This year, in particular at the Giro, I've noticed a lot of very inexperienced riders on the start sheet. Why that is, I don't know. I mean, the World Tour calendar is becoming ever more onerous, and teams are taking punts really on neo pros and throwing them in here to the mix. And you know, a lot will really find themselves or think they're out of their depth over the next few weeks. I mean, it was a very sort of almost poignant interview our colleague Kaylee Fretz did with some of the American riders, the young American riders here. He spoke to EAM Cycling's Larry Warbass the day before the prologue, I think, and asked the guys how they were feeling. And Larry Warbass was very, very downbeat, saying his legs probably felt like they were 8 out of 10, but compared to all the other riders in the field, they were 5 out of 10. And he was already, as the race started the other day, pretty pessimistic about how he was going to go and probably his prospects beyond this Giro. And it's a real voyage of self-discovery for guys like that. And you know, the other day in before the prologue, I was also speaking to Brent Copeland, the Lampre Merida team manager, and he was sort of running through his team and talking about young riders who they've got in their team, and again really on a knife edge as far as their careers are concerned. You know, Valerio Conti was a name that came up. He was one of the big prodigies in Italian cycling, considered the equal of Fabio Aru, was going to be a big star. And again, you know, someone who at this Giro d'Italia really needs to show something to guarantee his future.
Yeah, I mean, Sutilin, for example, is riding for a team which is going to have a lot of focus on them, Movistar. They've got Andre Amador already up there overall. Alejandro Valverde is the official leader of the team. Both of those riders are capable of finishing on the podium, possibly even winning it. And, I mean, I chatted to Sutilin yesterday morning. He did look nervous. He was fiddling about with his bike, spinning one leg round on his pedal because his power meter wasn't working. And he was just... We chatted for a little bit and he was explaining it's his first Grand Tour and that his job is in these early days just keeping Valverde out of the wind, being part of the little pocket of riders close by. And you're exactly right, Daniel. You know, riders will be judged on their performances in their first Grand Tour when they're given jobs to do. And if you're unable to do it because he's ill, and we don't necessarily know whether he was, you know, Sutilin may well have been able to do his job perfectly well for the first, four-fifths of the stage and then sit up and lose time on the way in. But when you've got a job to do, and we saw it with Alex Dowsett, another Movistar rider last year in the Tour de France, morale dips very, very quickly when they're unable to do the job that's been assigned to them.
You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at the Giro d'Italia, supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science in Sport, sponsoring the podcast at the Giro d'Italia, including Kilometre Zero from Monday. Monday, Wednesday and Friday will be Kilometre Zero Day. And our first one, as I mentioned earlier, is about the transfer from Holland to Italy, a little bit about what it's been like here and what it will be like in Italy. And we've got lots of riders and team directors' voices in there, so hopefully that'll be a good listen. If you want to buy Science and Sport products, they're offering an incredible 20% off on their website, www.scienceandsport.com. Enter the code SIS20, SIS20, and fill your boots with energy gels and drinks and bars and all kinds of...
I wouldn't fill your boots with energy gels. That might be a bit uncomfortable.
Might get a bit messy. But certainly eat them while cycling.
Yeah, don't fill your boots. That was just, it's just an expression. It's not meant literally.
La terza e ultima tappa olandese, perfettamente pianeggiante, fu segnata dalle raffiche di vento e da un inevitabile arrivo allo sprint. The third and last Dutch stage, which was perfectly flat, was marked by the gusts of wind and an inevitable sprint finish.
You struggle a bit with English, don't you there, Daniel?
Well, I'm translating on the hoof here. This is not been prepared today.
So that was another little vignette from Vincenzo Nibali's autobiography. We're going to be playing a line a day, aren't we?
Yeah, we've got some livelier, racier, particularly some racier extracts to come. I mean, so far they've been quite mundane, but I can guarantee that there's going to be some good stuff in there in the next few days.
Is it bodice ripping? Is it a bodice ripper?
Not
in places?
Not as bodice ripping as Danilo Di Luca's autobiography, but there is some of that, yeah.
Right. Look forward to that. Already the favourite thing that we've ever done on the podcast.
I wanted to mention another thing that you guys should look forward to over the next few days. When I leave you tonight, you know, you're going to be in the south of Italy. We've discussed this. We discussed yesterday Fabian Cancellara. Fabian Cancellara is going to be he's not his native region, but the region his family or half of his family is from, the south of Italy. I actually said that Praia Mare was in Basilicata. It's not quite in Basilicata, but on the border. However, the stage on Wednesday, I think, which is Praia Mare to Benevento, goes about 20 kilometres from the birthplace of Cancellara's father. Cancellara's father, Donato, an air conditioning technician, apparently, lived there for 18 years in a little place called Atella, which is about 20 kilometres from the route on Wednesday. So that should be interesting.
Maybe we'll detour and have ourselves a deep pan pizza there. Sorry, Daniel. Sorry. I am only joking. You know, I mean, the cuisine here in the Netherlands hasn't been the best, has it?
That is really the only negative note, isn't it? I mean, it has been, well, we've been speaking to various people from RCS over the last couple of days, RCS, the race organiser, and it has been an absolute triumph. It is the prototype of what a Grande Part, Grande Partenza should be. Huge crowds, a home hero, Tom Dumoulin, and they are really, you know, rubbing their hands. They can't believe their luck this week. And the weather, of course, has been unbelievable.
Yeah, the weather has been fantastic. And in that sense, anyway, it's everything that kind of Belfast and Dublin wasn't, because it was quite grey and overcast and cold. A bit drizzly in Dublin, but this has been absolutely fantastic.
And they've designed the stages, I think, with the fans in mind. They've given spectators a real good show. You know, we've had, where we are now, Arnhem has had a start and a finish.
As has Nijmegen.
So they've kept it in a small area. A lot of people have seen the race more than once, and the finishes have been on sort of circuits, so people have seen the riders pass twice or even three times. So it's been an all round a great experience. And you know, the Giro is always in competition with the Tour de France, obviously, but there was very little here to separate it from a Tour de France Grand Départ.
It is a case, though, some people imagine that it is a case of build it and they will come, and that's not necessarily the case here in Holland. Although there is great enthusiasm and great passion for cycling, great history as far as cycling is concerned. It's, again, speaking to people from RCS, they say that the towns and the local region and the province in particular have done an absolutely fantastic job. And if there have been so many people at the roadside, it's largely due to all the events they've organised. And going back, not just over the last few days, but weeks and months, they've really been whipping up a fervour over the Giro d'Italia, over the Grande Partenza, and they've been rewarded handsomely. It's been an absolute triumph.
And everyone's embraced it, haven't they? I mean, people are all around today wearing pink. Pink banners are up, pink bicycles hung on buildings, and there is something about that pink colour that does have an edge over, say, yellow for the Tour de France. I mean, yellow is obviously a very bright, summery colour, but there's something about pink. It's really visible, and it really is a case that this corner of Holland's been painted pink.
It is. It's a very... We were chatting this morning, Daniel and I, about the sort of the brand identity that the Giro has, the whole look and feel of the event, the logo, the imagery, everything about it is quite classy. The only thing I don't like, ironically, is their embrace of the English language in over Italian. They seem to, you know, they're really pushing for an English speaking audience. They see that as the emerging markets in cycling, and that the irony there is they perhaps don't appreciate that the English speaking audience probably likes the fact that it's Italian and actually want. They don't want it translated into English. I think the thing that makes the Giro and the Tour so appealing is the impenetrability of it to some extent, and part of that is the language.
I look forward to you guys embracing the Italian language.
I wanted to remain impenetrable. Well,
it's
going to
be impenetrable.
I
mean,
don't bother.
Pizza margarita, that's the same, isn't it? That's fine. We'll be fine. We'll be fine.
Hawaiian. Right. Well, we better wrap up there, chaps, because we've got to hitch a lift with Daniel and Simon, the photographer, to the airport in Amsterdam. And
where we're staying in a cupboard, by the looks of it. We're staying in an air...
Two cupboards, I hope.
I really hope so. Yeah, we're staying in a yotel. I'd not heard of yotel before, but it's a sort of... It is basically a cupboard in the airport.
It's like
a
morgue.
God.
I mean, I stayed in one at Gatwick once. I think it was Gatwick or Heathrow. Can't remember. But yeah, it's like a morgue. They pull it out and you climb in and they put you back in. Hopefully, it's a bit warmer than a morgue. But it should be fun. I think you sleep well.
But when we re-emerge in Italy on Tuesday with our next regular show after Tuesday's stage, we will be in the south of Italy. Hopefully the sun will be shining and we'll have had a couple of late afternoon cappuccinos to really get the energy levels up.
We're taking delivery of a vehicle there, which we will unveil smugly on Tuesday.
Can I add a final footnote, an erratum, in fact? I said 2 days ago, I think, that the contributors of our theme music for the Giro, Amara Terra, are from Salerno. They're actually from Salento, which is also in the south of Italy, but it's the other side, it's Puglia. And I was slightly concerned that you guys were going to be passing Salerno, thinking you were in their stomping ground. That's not the case, but nonetheless, we are extremely grateful for their fantastic music.
Love it. I think it really adds a lot to the podcast. Thank you to them. And thank you to you, Daniel. You know, hope the house move goes well, and we'll see you in Tuscany.
See you guys.
Yeah, I'll look forward to picking you up from the airport, Daniel.
And one of you will pick up my captain's armband.